And welcome to APG's Energy Insights. I'm Vern Stefanik, Director of Administration and Programs for APG, and this is a new podcast from AAPG. The today is Digging Deeper, by having a conversation with one of this year's speakers for the AAPG, AAPG Foundation's new Distinguished Lecture Series. Our guest today is Ashley Harris, the team leader for the Clastic Stratigraphy team at Chevron Energy Technology Company in Houston. And incidentally, Ashley's distinguished lecture, which is available for either downloading or streaming on the APG website, is titled Reevaluating the Relationship Between Relative Sea Level and Sediment Distribution Using Numerical Stratigraphic Forward Models. We'll talk about that a lot more in just a moment, but today we get to know a little bit more about Ashley and the work that went into his research and the passion that brought him to this moment in his career. Ashley, welcome to Digging Deeper.
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate being invited here. This is a wonderful opportunity, and I'm pretty excited.
Well, good. I'm serious. For all of you out there, this is, in fact, the very first AAPG podcast. New series that we're starting, which will feature all of our distinguished lectures, both in conversations and also their talks will be presented. But it also will feature people from throughout the energy industry. It's going to be an ongoing series, and we're glad that you all are listening to it. Ashley, we're glad that you're the first person to be part of it. And along those lines, let me tell you. So we're doing this largely because there was a member of the executive committee, APG executive committee, who said, we got to have podcasts and we got to get them going. And her name is Laura Johnson. That's our elected secretary for APG. And she is tremendously excited that you are the first guest. And she said, you have to ask him, what got you into geology?
Okay, good. So first, I'm excited to be the first one.
Okay.
That's pretty interesting. Maybe my kids will actually listen to me now because I'm on a podcast. Yeah. What got me into geology? That's a great question, Laura. The idea of being outside has always appealed to me.
Yeah.
You know, the notion that I could make a living by doing activities outdoors is great. You know, as a kid, I grew up in a pretty woodsy area in South Jersey, and so I was always outdoors doing things. And so the notion that you could, you know, make some money, but be outdoors is great. Also, geologists, generally, they're pretty cool people, right? Wearing plaid shirts and ripped up jeans, that appealed to me. Of course, today, that's not what I'm doing.
No, looking pretty sharp right now, I must say.
Thank you. But the idea that in geology, you could do so many different things. It's a field that integrates so many different disciplines of science. And so that's appealing to me. And quite frankly, it's challenging for me. It's not an easy science, and I enjoy that.
Well, let me ask you a little just specifically. You mentioned quickly that you're from New Jersey.
Yes.
So, coincidentally, coincidentally, over the past couple of years, we've had what I thought was an extremely large number of members of the APG Executive Committee who were from New York City. I mean, it's just kind of interesting, and they all had stories about what attracted them to specifically geology, which is why I asked you. So, and they talked about going to museums. They talked about finding rocks on the seashore.
Right.
Was there anything like that was appealing to you?
Yeah, I think so. I grew up in a place called the Pine Barrens, or on the fringe of the Pine Barrens.
Okay.
When most people think of New Jersey, they think of Newark Airport, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And they think the rest of New Jersey looks like that.
That's me. That was my first thought. Yeah.
And that's definitely not the case. Actually, South Jersey is beautiful. Like I said, it's Pine Barrens. And so, you know, I grew up around lots of pine trees and a whole bunch of sand.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the idea that I could do something, make a living by being in those kind of settings is great. And of course, there are not a lot of outcrops in South Jersey.
That's what I was going to ask about. Yeah.
Yeah. So actually, it wasn't until I got to grad school where at Rutgers University where I was able to be part of a drilling project to understand the paleoceanographic, paleoecologic, and sea level changes on the New Jersey margin going back 100 million years.
Ah.
And so that was a program where we took continuous core dating back to the Cretaceous. And so much of my work actually was looking at that core and developing a series of investigations from that core.
Well, let me interrupt you. So was there, so it sounds like it was more of the subject and the overall theme of geology rather than maybe a single teacher or a single class.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's accurate, although I've had some fantastic teachers encourage me to explore different things, different ideas, and not necessarily geologists, but people who were chemists and biologists who advised me to, you know, try a lot of different things. And I think that's my advice for anyone, any young person, say in high school or undergrad, is to try a bunch of things, especially if your curriculum allows for you to take different courses.
Yeah. Okay. Now, when you were at Rutgers, you were part of the New Jersey Coastal Plain Drilling Project.
Yeah.
That's what you were talking about before.
Yeah.
Could and I know that just that phrase means a lot to many people, but to some they may not understand completely what was the purpose of that. Was that school funded? Was that somebody else funded? And what happened to the results of all that? Why were you doing that?
Okay. So that's a program that was led by my advisor, Dr. Kenna Miller.
Okay.
And the idea was that they wanted to understand paleoceanographic changes, sea level changes on the New Jersey margin for the last 100 million years. And in fact, some of what I present in my AAPG Distinguished Lecture is the eustatic curve that was derived from the New Jersey margin. So he's been involved, and many others, including Jim Browning, Pete Sugarman, to name a few, have been involved in developing those records of the history of the New Jersey margin.
Okay.
And so I just plugged in. I was one of many students that plugged into that. And my focus was on the Paleocene, earliest Eocene, sea level changes and paleoceanographic changes. And I was very fortunate because I got experience sitting on a drill rig, describing core, washing core, doing biostratigraphic analysis. And all of those things were very appealing to me because you're integrating a bunch of different things to put together a story. And I think that's what also led me to the energy industry, because the energy industry requires integrators.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Let me back up a second. So what was the first rig where you sat?
Oh, gosh. I think it was, I can't remember if it was, oh, my advisor's going to kill me. I think it was Seagirt. I can't remember, but so there's a series of holes that were drilled on the New Jersey margin.
So you were offshore?
No, it's actually onshore.
Oh,
so okay. The funny thing is that a lot of the sites where the core was taken to do this analysis were in the Pine Barrens or, you know, in places where I went as a kid.
Okay.
Which, you know, I kind of never expected, right, to actually do my dissertation, you know, in some of those places. Places I drove by and never thought of.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's like dream come true. So, but it was the idea that you were dealing with the Earth in this large picture of how it was created, how it was formed.
Yeah.
Is that what was pulling you in?
Yeah, I think, we all go to the beach, we all go to the shore, and it's interesting to see how things can change over time.
Yeah,
and how those changes impact the ecology and a number of other things. And so for me, it just seemed like a natural fit. Although I was studying things that were 65 million years ago, so it's a lot different time. Half of New Jersey was underwater at that time.
But I got to think there weren't probably not a lot in your family, maybe a lot in your friends who from high school who were going this direction with their careers. This must have been, you were kind of unique, right?
Yeah, not too many friends from high school or elementary school, I don't think, went this path. Or maybe they did. They should contact me. I don't know. But, I grew up in a family that emphasized science in general.
Good.
And, being curious and, quite frankly, just being out of the house.
Well, yeah. This was like everything coming together for you. I love that. But so far in your story, almost everything is in Jersey.
Yes.
East Coast oriented all.
Yes.
And so your first job once you graduated from Rutgers was?
at Chevron.
Okay. So where was that?
Yeah, I was in New Jersey like forever. Never thought I'd leave. Of course, you know, have to get a job. And I did two internships with Chevron while I was in grad school. Very much loved it. I liked the people. I liked the types of projects, incredibly challenging projects. I don't have answers even for some of those projects, but that kind of problem solving appealed to me. And the fact that you could integrate a bunch of different tools to address those problems or solve those problems were appealing to me. The idea that you could integrate, you know, geophysics, classic, you know, stratigraphic characterization, reservoir characterization, biostratigraphy, chemostratigraphy, and of course the numerical models, which I talk about in the lecture series.
Yeah, and I want to get to that because that I think that that's fascinating that you go on that. But with Chevron, you started in their Mid-Continent business unit.
That's right.
Did you not? So
that's right.
So that and so you were not in Jersey. You were now
long left Jersey and into Houston, Texas. Texas has adopted me.
Okay.
And yeah, so that's where I started out in the Mid-Continent business unit, which is in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I was on a team focused on South Texas and asset development. When I got in the industry, I wanted to know kind of the nuts and bolts of how it worked. Identifying prospects and drilling. That's part of what we do.
Okay.
So that was a fantastic experience because I realized I had a ways to go, especially on things related to business, project management, and so on.
Did you have a feel even at that time on a specific direction that you were going to be heading in your career?
Yeah, I've always wanted to be a technical person. I enjoy those types of things.
Okay.
There are different types of roles that you can be in while you're at Chevron, and that technical role appeals to me because, once again, it's very challenging.
Yeah.
But even then, I knew that I needed to have some understanding of the base business. I think that's critical. That's the bottom line.
Right.
So I felt like that was part of my education, if you will, because the goal is to use the things that I'm presenting in the lecture series and try and apply it to business to help them, improve their results.
Okay.
That's the end goal.
The business of putting it all together.
That's right.
Yeah. Were there any specific challenges that surprised you as you were starting out on your career, as you were trying to figure all of this out, things that were completely unexpected just sort of hit you right in the nose?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, you know, coming out of grad school, doing your PhD, and then you're thrown into, you know, helping out a business, and you realize you know very little about some of the ongoings of the business, and that the business actually is quite complex.
Uh-huh.
Fortunately, Chevron has a support system to help us, get up to speed on certain aspects of the business.
Good.
And how projects are managed, and how your science and your geology can impact results.
Okay. Yeah. Was getting to Houston, was that a... was that a difficult and a lengthy process, or did something, an opening just came there and all of a sudden you were there? How did that happen?
It was all through recruiting. So we had recruiters come to Rutgers, and I got selected to do an internship. Did that with the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay.
I think part of what attracted Chevron to me was the fact that I was part of some of these drilling projects. And studied sea level and studied stratigraphy and biology or paleobiology, biostratigraphy to be exact, and geochemistry. So my background coming out of school was somewhat of an integrator, if you will. And I think those kind of skills appeal to the recruiters and, of course, the business units that brought me in as an intern. And then through that process, I was able to get a full-time job.
Okay. Well, your interest in the areas of things that you were gravitating toward, I guess even then, sea level was a big part of what you're doing.
Yeah.
In your talk, you make reference to APG Memoir 26, and that would have been Pete Vail.
Bob Mitchum.
Right, Bob Mitchum and Pete Vail
coming
up with their ideas. Was that a big part of your of your education, your path?
Oh, definitely. That was most definitely a large part of my education, especially when I got to grad school and was trying to delineate what are the eustatic changes, in particular for the Paleocene. And so, of course, I compared my work to their work. That was definitely part of the process. But learning, what they were trying to achieve in that. I think, there's a lot of discussion about that work with respect to the academic part and eustacy and that sort of thing. But what they were trying to do was come up with a way to explain why the stratigraphic record looked the way it did.
And it was pretty, pretty mind-blowing when it came out, right?
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. I think you can get a room full of stratigraphers in here, and we can go on and on about, that body of work. It was definitely a landmark work, but it was also pretty controversial in certain places, especially in certain parts of academia.
Can you talk in a little bit about that controversy? Because for you and for all those stratigraphers who would come into the room, it would be second nature. For some of the general public, it may be something that's vitally important to them, but they may not understand what it is that we're talking about. Can you talk a little bit about some of that?
I think part of it, a lot of the controversy, I think first and foremost, is whether or not we can actually measure, global sea level changes. How well can we resolve that? I think that's one of the major challenges. Exxon et al. And those groups did identify sequences or unconformities across the world that seem to correlate. But there are a number of controversies about the availability of that data, although some of the data that was used to construct some of those concepts did come out later. But what things they didn't take into account, things like compaction and tectonism, how well did they account for those things? Another consideration was the time resolution. How well was the time represented in that? So, I mean, there are a number of things.
So the whole adding the fourth dimension, then, you're talking about?
So the fourth dimension is another thing, which, I talk about, is how well does any one location really represent the entire body of sediment that's being deposited. So that's an area that I think is a part of ongoing research.
We'll tell you what. Let's talk a little bit about the research that's going on, and we'll talk a little bit about your paper too. Although your lecture, I'm kind of hoping that everybody's going to actually watch the lecture so they can see what's going on. But to get us to the point, your lecture, I'm going to guess, comes out of a lot of the research that you have been working on. And I'm guessing that it hasn't been research that was just in the past couple of months. This has been an ongoing project for you, right?
Yeah, definitely. So, in some ways, there are some roots going back to grad school, because that's where I was involved in studying sea level. But obviously, the energy industry, has been really focused on sea level changes as it relates to the stratigraphic record. So, where are your source and seal rocks and that sort of thing. So this has kind of been baking for a while. And of course, I've been involved in exploration research. So mostly focused on reservoir prediction. So where are the reservoirs? How much sand is there? And this is one of those outcomes from that, those types of studies.
For some of the people who are not not necessarily geologists, where the sand is coming and where the sand is being deposited, that's a sign that we may have some energy there to be found. Is that correct?
So there's multiple parts to what makes a hydrocarbon system. Mostly what I'm talking about is the reservoir part, the sand part. But obviously there are other things around tectonism, the seal, whether hydrocarbons generated and migrated into the reservoir. So I'm only looking at one of many aspects, which is why there are teams of people that are focused on each one of those different aspects.
Speaking of teams, you are the team lead, which you were not always team lead. You've gotten to that position. What has that journey been like, and how has that changed your life, by the way?
So I recently came into that role. And it's been a huge change. I think you go from being, individual contributor. You're the one, as I call it, pressing the button. I'm the one that's doing all the technical work. I am directly involved. I am hands-on. And I think the biggest change is that now you have to work with people and work through people to accomplish goals. So I will not be the one always hands-on in that. Mm-hmm. And so that's a different, that's a new challenge. And so far, I'm with a great group of people. They've been very easy on me. They've made it a pretty easy transition. But, obviously some more work to do there.
Do you, when do you find the time to do your own personal research? Because you're still, I was a writer.
Yes.
For a long time, and then I got made an editor.
Okay.
But that didn't stop my desire to write,
okay.
And I still wanted to find time to do that.
Did you still write?
Yeah. But it was on my own time after hours.
Okay.
And I would, stick around up late at night trying to write my own personal things, mm-hmm. because during the day I was concerned with editing other people's writing.
Right.
As a researcher, I'm going to guess that you are really wired into what your team is doing.
Right.
And yet, since you were in high school practically, you've had this urge, this desire, right, to research and understand and to answer questions and all.
Right.
How have you made that? How do you make that work?
Yeah, I actually still have to do some of my own research, even as the team leader. That's one of the expectations. In fact, we're called a technical team leader. Okay. So that's still one of the expectations. It is nowhere near to the scale that it was before I was doing this work. But I do still find time to do it. And even a little bit of the writing and presentation stuff is obviously done off hours. But yeah. I enjoy doing that. I think that's something that's always going to be there for me. And so these days, like I said, it's mostly focused on making sure the overall team delivers what's needed for the business. And so that's most of the focus, and just a little bit of time for myself. And I still do some of that work for sure, but not as much.
I got it. I got it. When you get together as a team, I'm going to assume some things. You tell me that I'm wrong, because I've never been part of a research team.
Okay.
Do you as a team get together periodically to say, this is what we need to tackle? Or does the company come to you and say, here's something that we need to have figured out?
Yeah.
Go get them.
Yeah. It goes both ways in those regards. We work, so I'm part of the technology company, which is a service company,
mm-hmm.
and we service many of the business units.
Yeah.
And by interacting with the business units and providing products for them, they tell us what they need.
Mm-hmm.
But in that process, we also identify things that could help the job be a little bit smoother.
Mm-hmm.
And so it definitely goes both ways.
Okay, so there are practical applications that are expected to come out of what might be considered an academic approach to research. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely.
Practical?
In fact, we definitely do work with academics on many of these problems. But what comes out of that research, it has to be applied. So at some point, you have to apply it.
Okay.
You have to demonstrate its value. So that's definitely a large part of the job.
So can you comment at this point? Let's go back, and I'm going to have to read this, I'm sorry again, to the title of your talk, which is Reevaluating Relationship Between Relative Sea Level and Sediment Distribution. And then we get into that using the numeric stratigraphic forward models.
Yeah.
Stratigraphic. Yeah. So in doing that research, was there something that was going on that made you think, I need to challenge the accepted thought on this?
Yeah, the motivation was to better understand, not necessarily challenge, but test.
Mm-hmm.
At its very core, science, you're supposed to produce testable hypotheses. And one of the things available to us are these numerical models. And the benefit of the numerical models is that they integrate a bunch of processes, quite frankly. And so that's a great playground or area to really test ideas and see if how we view the world or how the world behaves is reasonable. And the benefit of the numerical models is that they are rooted in our best understanding of sediment routing, deposition, the interaction between sea level, tectonism, and mm-hmm. many other processes like channel migration, avulsion, slope failure.
Yeah.
So all of that is housed within those numerical models. And we can see how systems may respond to different forcings.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say forcing, I mean something like sea level or sediment supply change or tectonic change.
Mm-hmm.
And at a basin scale, understanding those interactions are critical, mm-hmm. Especially in exploration settings where you're trying to quantify, say, the volume of sediment that goes into a basin or where it may be located within a given basin.
Have there already been surprises to you in some of your findings?
Yeah, definitely. We had quite a few surprises. In fact, it called into question, like, wait, is this right? For example, we found that peaks in deep water sand delivery correspond to the fall, the minima, and the rise in sea level, which is a little bit different than the conceptual model.
Okay.
And in fact, I think it does support that conceptual model, but expands it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so those kind of things were unexpected and caused us to really dig in and think about what's happening within the model. And of course, we try to cross-validate those models against either field studies or physical tank experiments.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay, so are there specific locations that you're looking at, or is this just theoretical anywhere on Earth?
The application is really anywhere.
Okay.
Because we've set up something that I would consider a generic margin, for example, a generic passive margin. So I think it's applicable anywhere because the processes occur everywhere, right? All the processes of avulsion, sea level change, compaction, diagenesis, slope failure, waves, currents, it happens everywhere. And so what's important is understanding those interactions. Now, granted, there may be areas that are more unique or have, unique situations.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure all of the concepts can be applied immediately everywhere, but we do find some common themes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is it, I want to put the cart ahead of the horse, but it seems like you must be moving toward, there are going to be practical applications over some of what your findings are going to be.
Yeah, for example, in my talk, I talk about how we apply no eustatic variation model and a eustatic variation model.
Yeah.
And we look at the total volume of sand that's delivered to deep water.
Right.
And we find that there's very little difference. So what does that mean for an exploration? Well, focus on the volume of sediment that's actually getting delivered to that basin. Of course, there are going to be some challenges with respect to where that sand ends up in the basin. But at least in our very simple model case, we find that there are minimal differences. But that's at a large scale,
okay.
Both spatial and temporal. Definitely there is some influence from sea level on shorter time scales. Also, to have no sea level changes over long time scales, that's unreasonable. That's definitely not happening.
Yeah.
But one of the things we highlight is that things are not as simple as you think they are. That's our take on it. But effectively, when it comes to things like the volume or even maybe the magnitude of a deep water sand delivery event, there are multiple processes that can give you a similar result. So that's actually not a bad thing. It's just a cautionary note when we describe the rock record or interpret the rock record.
Right.
Because it means there could be multiple controls that give you a similar result.
Where are you in the research? What I mean by that is, have you come to a place where you feel confident that you've gone about as far as you can go and you're getting ready to tackle something else? Or have you gotten to the point where you realize, oh my gosh, we've just touched the surface on what's about to happen?
Yeah. I think for this particular project, I'm closing up. I'm near the
okay.
end. What we've done is done a series of publications and presentations. And I think what's important that we, present that view to the geologic community and, let them to continue to investigate it and really interrogate it. I was fortunate enough to test some long-held ideas, and it's possible someone will test mine. But I think it's a great opportunity for the rest of the community to maybe pick it up and think about it a little bit more.
I love it.
And maybe in ways that I didn't think about it.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's why I'm thankful for Chevron for allowing us to publish it, because it's a contribution to science, and we'll see where it goes.
God, will your team stay together on the next project, or do you reassemble and have a completely new team?
No. This is the same team. Actually, that was work I did before I became a team leader.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Those group of people are still around, but this will become less of a focus, mostly because that's thinking about things at a large scale. Mm-hmm. These days, I'm much more focused on a much smaller spatial scale.
Last question, and there's actually, and I know we've been setting up the details of your distinguished lecture. So I really hope people take the opportunity to go to the website and just watch you in action and talking about this, because I think it is provocative. I think it is something that is intriguing to everybody to really consider and to consider the practical applications of everything that's going on. Last question though, that I want to ask you about if that room full of stratigraphers would gather at this moment, how do you think they would respond to the research that you've done?
Yeah, I've gotten some actually very positive responses, even from some of our competitors. It's actually been, I've had an interesting exchange between myself and some of those folks. So far it's been positive. I've gotten some negative responses too, but that's to be expected from science, right? The idea is that everything, as I previously mentioned, has to be testable. And so that I've put something out there to be tested, and let's see if it stands the test of time. And the reality is that many of these concepts really only required some modification or refinement. But like I said, I've put something out there, and let's see. I'm sure if you got some other stratigraphers, they would have a different point of view. But in some ways, I'm not completely disagreeing with some of those concepts. I just think that they need to expand just a little bit. That's what me and my co-authors think.
Love it. All the more reason for people to tune in to your distinguished lecture.
Excellent.
I can't wait for that to go out and to go around the world and give people the opportunity to be part of it. But I can't end without saying, so this has to be like a totally engagement of your time. You're a real person, right? I mean, there must be things that... What do you do when you're not doing research?
Oh, wow.
Who are you?
All right, who am I? I love cars. I really like cars. I like really anything, all things mechanical. But, I often go to Coffee and Cars. It's a gathering of cars from all over Houston. People bring everything from... Corvettes and different American muscle to different Italian exotics. It's pretty nice. It's a great opportunity to get very close to things that would be a poster on your wall. Things were a poster on my wall as a kid. But also, I've seen some pretty amazing cars. I saw our early 1900s Cadillac. I mean, that thing was incredible. And I wish I took a picture of it, but it looked like one of those kind of horse buggy type of things, but had a motor. So that was incredible. You get to see drag cars and all types of things, even some extremely lifted trucks and massive tires. And you just see people with a passion for vehicles.
Right.
And they go to an extent I personally probably wouldn't, but it's nice to see that kind of stuff. It's nice to see the level of engineering that goes into these things that we use to get to work and go to the grocery store.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, what's been the coolest car you've ever had, but maybe it's just your favorite car that you've ever had.
Oh goodness, I don't know if I've had my favorite car yet. That's what I'm gonna say for now. Coming out of grad school and obviously I'm raising three kids right now. It's a little bit challenging to get the car of my dreams or my favorite car. But right now I'm driving a Subaru WRX, and that fits the bill right now.
Okay.
Also, I have other hobbies I'm interested in as well, so it does take a little bit of my money.
Do you, I said this would be no more questions, but I'm always intrigued by what inspires people.
Yeah.
So I believe like if I'm writing one thing, whatever that would be, let's say I'm writing a play.
Yeah.
Why would I do that? But let's say I'm doing that. I would be, there's something that's complementary that I'm reading or listening to.
Right.
And when once I wrote a musical and I listened, while I was writing one, I was listening in detail and analyzing another one completely because there was some sort of connection that kept me going through all this. Where do you get your inspiration? Okay. Where does that come from?
Inspiration, I'm around some really creative and smart people and have been fortunate to be around them. Mm-hmm. And just by interacting with them, you get to, you know, bounce ideas, really challenge ideas, test your ideas.
Uh-huh.
And that's been great. I recommend, you know, always get around people who are either more creative than you, smarter than you. You know, they have a certain gravity, and I think they'll pull you along, and they'll, you know, help you, better execute your ideas, but also inspire you. Inspiration comes from lots of places, even my kids, my middle one, my daughter wants to be a geologist.
Ooh.
And so she's always picking up rocks, some of them for which I, don't know what they are. And, from them, I get a little bit of inspiration. Kids ask some amazing questions. They actually can put you in a tough spot.
Yeah.
And then you realize you don't know as much as you think. So I actually have them, take a look at some, PowerPoint I'm building for, AAPG or something
like
that. And they always chime in. I've put them in some of the acknowledgments of my papers.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, cool dad. Cool everything. And thank you for that. Thank you for taking the time to be here and to share with us. So we got to know you a little bit more. I cannot wait to see the rest of your lecture, which once again, I'll remind everybody, will be available on our website for either downloading or streaming services. So thank you. We've been talking today to Ashley Harris, team leader for the Clastic Stratigraphy team at Chevron Energy Technology Company in Houston. Be sure to check out his lecture at aapg.org. I'm telling you, it's a good one. And watch this space for more AAPG podcasts that will cover a variety of important subjects, innovative ideas, and intriguing people, including our ongoing Digging Deeper look at this year's Distinguished Lecturers. The Distinguished Lecture Program is a jointly operated program by AAPG and the AAPG Foundation. We hope you'll take a moment soon to check out the AAPG Foundation website to learn about how you can be part of ensuring the future of geosciences. For now, thanks for listening.